the Slate Political Gabfest. January 11th, 2024, the Should Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin Be Fired edition. I'm David Plotz of CityCast. I'm in Washington, D.C. John Dickerson of CBS Primetime is on a much-deserved vacation. Emily Bazelon of New York Times Magazine and the University of Boston is here. Hello, Emily.
Hello, hello.
And sitting in for John, one of our all-time favorites, one of your all-time favorites, listeners, New York Times op-ed columnist Jamel Bowie, live from Charlottesville, Virginia. Hello, Jamel.
Hello, hello.
This week on the Gabfest, the Pentagon and Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin are bumblingly trying to explain away his secret illness and hospitalization. Should he lose his job over this snafu, this mess up? Then judges seem poised to reject Trump's immunity claims in D.C., even as the Georgia case against Trump may fall apart over potential misconduct by the Fulton County DA. Then we'll be joined by Alec McGillis to discuss the crisis in school absenteeism and what can be done about it. And of course, we'll have cocktail chatter. And I have maybe the greatest cocktail chatter that's ever been. I'm just previewing that.
Wow, that's setting a really high standard.
Yeah, it may also be the worst cocktail chatter that's ever been.
I like that it could land on either extreme. That makes me excited.
I would bet that neither Emily nor I could have told you a single fact about Lloyd S. Austin a week ago. Jamel.
Lie. Maybe I know all about him. Anyway, go ahead, Jamel.
Jamel probably could have, because Jamel comes from a military family, and I feel like Jamel is more up on things. The SecDef, who is a former general, is famously private and low-key, which may explain the phenomenal FUBAR set of mistakes he's made in the last month. It has now come out that Austin had prostate surgery in late December, was rehospitalized with complications on New Year's Day, hid his medical issues from the White House and even his own aides in some sense until the crisis eased around January 4th. His own Deputy Defense Secretary, Kathleen Hicks, was given temporary authority over the department during his illness, but even she did not know why she was getting this temporary authority. The White House also didn't know anything about it until soon before it became public. And all this was happening while the U.S. was drone striking in Iraq and engaged in military matters in Israel and Ukraine. So Emily, it's obviously a mistake that Austin made, and it's obviously like a glaring and any other person on the planet, seemingly, you know, a mistake you shouldn't have made. Like, it was glaring to everybody. It was so obvious. But is it a firing offense or a resigning offense?
No. I feel like this is such an old school kind of, I mean, to even use the word scandal seems wrong. The indignation that I'm reading about it feels so obligatory to me. Like, in the post-Trump era,
isn't it fun to get indignant about something that feels so low stakes? It's from 1984.
Exactly. And it feels super low stakes. You can kind of sympathize with him. He obviously treasures his privacy, don't we all? Yes, of course, he should have told people where he was. His deputy should have known if she was on deck. And like, nothing went wrong. So I don't know. In the end, let's all move on.
So Jamel, do you think there's anything that the world can learn from this particular self-inflicted wound?
This one's tough because I'm also inclined to Emily's position that, like, even in the scheme of like a 90s scandal, because this feels very sort of like Clinton 93 to me.
Yeah, that's a good one. Clinton 93. Excellent analogy.
even on those terms, this just feels very minor and not that big of a deal. I suppose it may raise questions simply about the communications between the Department of Defense and the White House. Like, I think it should have been the case. As much as I understand Lloyd Austin's desire for privacy, he is someone who is within the chain of command. He is not, you know, the president is his boss, and I think he does have an obligation to let the White House know what's going on. The thing that gives me a little bit of pause about this is just sort of like the kind of assumption of total autonomy that the Department of Defense, like, or Austin kind of assumed there, is a little bit troubling, not in like the biggest way, but sort of like, you don't want this kind of thing to become a habit. You really want the military in particular to feel obligated to tell the White House what its top officials are doing. So that's like my one kind of like, this is where it becomes something worth taking a little seriously. But I don't think it's worth the consternation. We're recording this the day after the Republican debate in Iowa between Nikki Haley and Ron DeSantis, and I was watching that, and they were like, "Oh, a commander in chief should never not know exactly what is happening. This was a complete failure of leadership by Joe Brandon." You know, it's that's a bit much.
Fred Kaplan in Slate made the argument that he should be fired simply for being so irrelevant to the Biden operation that he could be AWOL for weeks and no one cared or needed to know.
I totally take issue with that. The reason I actually really do know right now who Lloyd Austin is that I think he's been helpful about the Israel-Hamas war. He made a speech a few weeks ago talking about the danger of strategic defeat for Israel, which I thought was like a good way of having the Biden administration sound an extra note of caution and concern about what the Israelis are doing that wasn't Biden himself talking. So I thought that critique that he's irrelevant, it just seemed especially wrong to me right now.
The thing about that critique is that like it's not as if the Secretary of Defense is, strangely enough, some high-profile official, right? Like, sometimes they can be. Donald Rumsfeld was, Mark Esper was, largely because Trump himself was, like, you know, trying to overthrow the government, so Esper was taking his oath to the Constitution quite seriously. But past Secretary of Defenses have been relatively low-key. And so the idea that Austin should be fired or should resign because he's not... it doesn't appear to be that big of a deal or that important to the Biden administration, just seems a little off key. Like, well, this is like a bureaucratic administrative job, and it isn't necessarily a policymaking job like the Secretary of State.
I like the idea that he's just a person who really values his privacy and has sought to maintain it, even despite a very successful career in the military and now obviously a very large job, but that you could, in a world where most people are angling for attention and likes and media coverage, that he just doesn't care, doesn't want it. And you know, to his detriment in this case, because it made him overvalue that privacy and make a mistake about it. But it is a refreshing tonic in a world where very few people are like that.
Also, who doesn't sympathize with, like, you know, trying to send the occasional text or email and pretending that you're there when you're not? Which, I don't know, maybe that's not what he was doing, but that was immediately what my mind went to. It was like, oh, yeah, I don't need to put my out of office message on. I'll just occasionally waft in.
I'm here. Yeah, that's right.
Here, exactly.
He wasn't golfing. That was what I would be doing. I'd be golfing. I'd be like, oh, I'm just checking in.
Right. That is sort of the other thing. It's like, if he had been on recreation, I think the outrage would make a little more sense. But he was undergoing cancer treatment. And that is a little understandable. Again, the Department of Defense should let the White House know these things. But
I think this prompts a really great Washington party game, which is the who matters game based on, would anyone care if that person was in the hospital? And I was making sort of a mental list, like what positions in Washington would anyone care about if they were in the hospital? And my list is president, Supreme Court justice.
It depends on what day of the week, frankly. Only if there's oral argument.
Right, yeah.
Like, no, because people are...
Oh, in the hospital.
Like,
oh,
they might die. Okay. There's going to be an opening.
Okay, fair enough.
Chair of the Fed... Maybe, and then I think maybe Secretary of State, maybe Secretary of Defense, I guess Vice President, and that's maybe Secretary of the Treasury. That's it. Like, if the Secretary of Labor is in the hospital,
I'd say the Speaker of the House.
Really?
Right? Really?
Yeah, I was thinking that too.
I'd say. I mean, maybe not this Speaker of the House, but like. If Nancy Pelosi had been in
Mitch
the hospital.
McConnell, we
yeah,
would
Mitch
care.
McConnell.
Mitch McConnell. Yeah, Mitch McConnell. We would care if Mitch McConnell was in the hospital. No. I would care.
But is there anybody else? I mean, I there's very few other people that it would matter.
That's a really good question. The chief of staff, White House chief of staff, I think that is sort of a very critical job if they were in the hospital.
And they're probably in the hospital because they're so stressed out, which indicates something else that's happening. I like that one. The final note I'm going to make on this, I wanted to talk about this because it is because of its quality of being like a Caribbean vacation compared to most of the shit we have to talk about on this on the GabFest, because the world is so depressing. So I'm glad we got to do it. I realized it was trivial, and I'm going to even trivialize it even more, which is, and Jamel, as a military brat, maybe you can comment on this. I was just surprised to discover that the spokesman for the Pentagon is a major general. The guy who's the spokesman of the Pentagon, the press secretary of the Pentagon, is Major General Pat Ryder. It seems like that should be a job that like a captain or a lieutenant colonel could do. Like, do they really need a major general? Shouldn't this guy be commanding tanks or something?
I mean, there's a whole in all the branches, there's basically like a public relations and public affairs and communications like core, basically. Like, that's the thing you can do going into the service. I just pulled up Pat Ryder's bio here, and he was commissioned through the Air Force ROTC back in 92. So this actually makes total sense to me. Like, he went to college, he was ROTC, he graduated, he got his commission as an officer, and as a college boy, he probably was like just directed into communications and public affairs in the Air Force, and that's like a totally normal career track. And so this makes total sense to me. Like, he's an Air Force Major General, but like, I don't know a ton about the Air Force, but I think I would consider that more sort of like, yeah, he's been promoted a bunch. And when you're promoted a bunch and you're an officer, right, sort of like, he didn't enlist. So he's an officer, you're promoted a bunch. That's, you know,
one day you wake up as a Major General. You're one day you wake up old. As a Major
it's General. It's like being Vice President of Comms.
Right,
or
right.
Something.
Exactly.
Man, I could have been a major general by now. I graduated in 92.
A modern major general.
I definitely would have been a modern major general.
The very model of a modern major general.
I am the very model of a modern major general. I've information, vegetable, animal, and mineral. I know the kings of England, and I quote the fights historical from Marathon to Waterloo in order categorical. I am very well acquainted too with matters mathematical.
I'm looking at it is kind of cool to be, you're like a public relations guy, but you get to wear a fancy uniform and you have all these bars to indicate your rank. It's like, have you seen those portraits of New York City sanitation collection officials, like high ranking officials? They have like the coolest uniforms and like the bars and everything. More professions should have that, right? When you get to the top, you get a dope uniform and some like flair.
My father was in the public health service, and I have his public health service uniform, and he had like a very high rank in the public health service, and I think he even had a sword. I mean, it was
that rules. Ridiculous. That what? Rules. Could you imagine? Could you imagine? You're editor of a magazine, and they give you a sword.
That would be amazing. Do you want to hear more from us after this episode? I bet you do. After that segment, you should definitely stick around for our bonus segment. Today, we're going to be talking about if you had to make a second Mount Rushmore. First of all, that would be very difficult. But second of all, what four presidents would you put on it and why? This segment is just for Slate Plus members, however. So if you are a Slate Plus member, thank you. Because of your support, we've been able to keep the GabFest going these many years. But if you're not a Slate Plus member, think about signing up. We'd love it. You'll get bonus segments of every episode of the GabFest and other Slate podcasts. You'll hear Jamel. Jamel is practically, he's Slate Plus royalty. You cannot find a great Slate Plus segment at Slate without Jamel on it, even though he doesn't even work at Slate anymore. So you'll get lots of Jamel. You'll get discounts at live shows. You'll get no hitting the paywall on the Slate site. And so if you're a member, again, thank you. If you're not a member, go to slate.com/GabFest Plus to become a member today. slate.com/GabFest Plus. This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey everyone, it's MSNBC's Chris Hayes. For the first time since 1892, we have an election in which both candidates have presidential records. It's a chance to take a hard look at what Joe Biden and Donald Trump have actually done as president. On a special Why Is This Happening podcast series called With Pod 2024 The Stakes, I'm talking to experts about the two candidates' records on specific policy areas like immigration, taxes, climate, and more. So you know what's at stake come November. Search for Why Is This Happening and follow.
A three-judge panel of the D.C. Circuit seemed very skeptical of former President Trump's claim this week that he's entitled to full immunity from prosecution for acts he undertook as president, notably the actions he undertook which brought to overturn the election and which led to charges from special counsel Jack Smith. So, Emily, start by telling us what Trump was claiming and how the judges were skeptical of him.
Oh, man. I mean, Trump is making an extremely broad argument. He is arguing for absolute immunity. So the idea is it doesn't matter what crime he is alleged to have committed. He may not be prosecuted because all of it is somehow part of his official duties in the presidency. That basically there is no crime for which a president can be prosecuted unless he has already been impeached and convicted by the Senate. And this led to these amazing hypotheticals where the judges said things like, well, if you sent a bunch of Navy SEALs in to assassinate your political rival, would that be a crime? And the lawyer said, well, you'd have to be impeached and convicted first, to which the Justice Department lawyer said, well, what if you resign? So effectively, this creates this enormous loophole. It's not an argument that the court is going to accept.
And it was in absolute contradiction, Jamel, with the arguments that Trump himself made during his last impeachment. I can't even remember which number impeachment it was, his second impeachment, I guess, which was that, oh, he shouldn't be convicted in the Senate. It was the criminal courts would be the place to sort out these charges. So when it's convenient for him to say this should be a criminal court trial, he says that. When it's convenient for him to say, oh, it's impeachment in the Senate, impeachment and conviction in the House and Senate, he says that.
Right. I mean, the thing I kept thinking of reading former president's lawyers make this case for kind of total presidential immunity is that it's legalistic is the wrong adjective. I can't think of the one I want to use, but it feels like completely divorced from any common sense understanding of the constitutional system, right? Like, I suppose that given present law, current law, like, you know, the recent precedent around the executive branch over the past few decades, I suppose there's a case the former president's lawyers could make that there is some expansive presidential immunity. But if you just like pause and like step back for a second and ask yourself, and I'm saying this not as someone who's an originalist, right? Like thinking commonsensically, what was the purpose of the Constitution? Like, what's the idea here? And the very explicit, like, clear, unambiguous idea was that elected officials, and specifically the top official, the top leader of the country, are bound by laws. The whole complaint of the revolutionary generation, the two main complaints is that first, we don't have adequate representation as members of this polity. And second, the king is not bound by anyone. And that is like that offends our sense of how this should work. And so to think that given like the premise of American democracy, like rest on even the top guy is bound by not just the public, but by a set of rules and institutions. The idea that there's some total presidential immunity just doesn't make any conceptual sense, because then that's not a president, right? Like, by definition, that's no longer a president. If the person in the office of the presidency could, you know, get SEAL Team 6 to assassinate his rivals and then pardon all of them, or just have it do it and not even bother with that and say, well, you know, this is a duty as president. This is my duty as president. Then that person isn't a president anymore. That person exists beyond the rule of law, beyond constitutional government. They're like a dictator, or if not a dictator, they're some sort of like autocratic figure, but they're not a president. And so it's sort of like the law aside, just thinking about the political system, by definition, a president is bound by law. by definition. Otherwise, they're not a president.
There is a more serious argument here, which Trump's lawyer also made, to be fair to him, which is the idea that, you know, if you're a president in office and you're making difficult decisions, say in wartime, he talked about, you know, George W. Bush during the Iraq War or Obama sending out drones, that you can't do those things if you're constantly looking over your shoulder, that you might get prosecuted, right? The problem with the argument in this context, to connect back to what you're saying, Jamel, is that it's really hard to see how Trump was acting within his official duties as president when what he was doing was trying to mess around with election results. That's really about his interest as a candidate. And so that part of the picture seems really important. One concern I had listening to the oral argument was there was one judge who talked about, well, maybe we need to send this back to the district court for more fact-finding about the distinction between official duties and private acts as a candidate. And the problem with that, of course, is delay. Every beat, every day that passes is helpful to Trump in pushing this case down the road to when he will be presumably officially the Republican nominee for president, and then maybe even the president if he wins in November and this case goes away.
As I've said on the Gabfest many times before, his strategy is to lose every battle, but to fight every battle. And then one day you wake up and if he wins the election, he's president and all of this stuff effectively can go away. And this, he's already the legal arguments were preposterous. The judges will throw them out. That when it gets to the Supreme Court will also reject them. We know that. I mean, you can be pretty confident the Supreme Court's going to reject them. But it's going to be, when is that going to be, Emily? Is it going to be April? Is it going to be May? Is it going to be June?
Can I just say that I don't think the Supreme Court has to take this case. Like, I think that one completely plausible and acceptable outcome would be a ruling for a 3-judge panel at the D.C. Circuit, and that's it. And we just, like, move
on. Well, Trump will appeal. Trump will appeal it.
Oh, he will appeal, but it's up to the, first of all, the entire D.C. Circuit, all 11 of them. They could rehear the case. They could not. The Supreme Court can also decide not to rehear the case. So in other words, that the further delay you're imagining, while it's totally possible it will happen, it does not have to happen.
What can the district court, the trial court judge do to restart the trial? Can the trial court judge say, you know, while this is being appealed to the Supreme Court, I'm going to start the trial anyway? I mean, it's going to require a final disposition, even if it's a rejection by the Supreme Court. And that,
yeah, but a rejection by the Supreme Court could take days. That could happen very quickly. It's the court hearing the case that takes time.
What is your sense, Jamel, about politically how all this pregame litigation, the non-trials that are preceding the trials, how it's playing politically?
I don't think it's playing politically at all. I think this is that sort of like the sub, not sub political level, but like the sub level that people, normal people pay attention to. I don't think anyone really has any sense of this stuff unless they're like paying close attention. I mean, to be perfectly honest, this is my job and I have to like say to myself, I'm going to pay attention to this stuff now to see what's happening. So I don't think it really is playing politically. I think that when there's a big headline, right? Appeals court, you know, rejects Trump's immunity claim. Supreme Court declines to hear, you know, that kind of thing. That will begin to break through to the public, but not this level of stuff. I do think. I mean, I'm of the view that if you know when Trump on trial during an election is going to create constant coverage that is not good for him. And so I think that will have an effect politically. It's going to remind people of all the things they did not like about Trump's 4 years in office. But we're not at that stage yet. I would like to make one sort of like broad point about how American government is structured that like kind of produces this sort of dilemma. And that is that, you know, most people learn, I think, in, you know, high school civics or high school government or whatever, that the founding fathers didn't like political parties and sort of like, you know, George Washington warns against faction in his farewell address and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I think it's just sort of like typically given as a throwaway as part of like Americans' like longstanding suspicion of parties and partyism. But I think, which I kind of don't have that much time for, but the interesting thing is that it's not just that they didn't like parties, but that like the structure of American government was not built with political parties in mind. And that has like real implications for how everything plays out in practice. Like one of them, for instance, is that like we basically had to like jerry-rig a party system onto the constitutional system. You see this in the history of the Electoral College, which within like a decade is completely unrecognizable from what was designed in terms of how it works in practice. Very quickly, state legislatures are realizing that like, oh, we can't have it work the way it was written down because otherwise our party's candidate will lose. And that is, you know, you have this process that ends basically by the 1820s of kind of figuring out how this particular institution is going to work within the context of political parties. But the president, right? The president as party leader is a thing that had to be like innovated and created and then sort of like imposed onto the system, because constitutionally the president parties don't exist and the president is not a party leader. And so you do have this, and to add to this, parties end up becoming the necessary connective tissue for presidents to even work their will on the legislature. And so it is this interesting tangle, right, where the president you can't really fully separate official presidential duties and party duties, because the two are entwined together by necessity and have been basically since Thomas Jefferson. And this is a thing that maybe in a better design system, a more modern system, wouldn't be as much of an issue. But you know, we have essentially kind of like modern politics on top of an 18th century design.
And so, Jamel, are you connecting this because the argument that Trump was acting somehow within the sphere of the presidency by trying to, you know, in his view, prevent fraud in the election?
Right. I think that's not a serious argument, but in a funny way, it kind of like raises sort of like an interesting problem with the structure of American government that like, yeah, there actually is no clean separation between president as party leader and president as constitutional officer. By contrast, you can make an actually kind of clean separation between like Supreme Court justice as member of a political coalition, Supreme Court justice as you know, legal guy, right? Like that's a separation that's possible to make, because the former is not necessary to the latter, right? Like you can, which is how you get guys like Charles Evans Hughes, who go from being elected officials to Supreme Court justices to like presidential candidates. This transition is possible to make, but the presidency isn't like that.
And it also means that the legislature, rather than thinking of its job the president's party in the legislature, rather than thinking of its job as being the accountability, holding the president to account and being a separate force, thinks of itself as in fact an enabler and an ally. And that makes impeachment an impossible tool once that dynamic is built.
The emergence of political parties basically renders a bunch of the accountability mechanisms of American style government like inert, like they don't work. Because of the nature of political parties. And then you could say, oh, we should get rid of political parties. But like, there's a pretty good case to make that democracy cannot exist without political parties. Like it's part of the thing. And so you have, you know, we are running into this situation where we're kind of running into the limits of what you can do with American style constitutional government, but also like the things that make democracy work, like political parties.
That's why we need a parliamentary system. Before we go, I just want to hit on what's happening in Georgia, because Emily, there's this really amazing story this week that Fannie Willis, who is leading the Georgia criminal prosecution of former President Trump over all the stuff that was done in Georgia to overturn the election, was accused this week of having a secret, inappropriate relationship, an affair, I guess is what's being implied, with a lawyer named Nathan Wade, who has been paid $654,000 by Atlanta to assist Willis's office on prosecutions, including prosecutions of Trump and co-defendants. Willis may have taken lavish vacations with Wade, vacations that presumably were funded by his government contracts that she is funneling to him. What's your sense about how damaging this is to Willis and, more importantly, to the case against Trump that Willis and Wade have been working on.
I mean, it depends what's true in all of this, right? So she hasn't responded. It's not clear to me whether the most serious allegations are true. Is she having an affair with him? Did she go on this vacation? Who paid for it? It's shining a spotlight on the fact that she hired Wade for this important role in this big sprawling RICO case, even though he has little or no criminal law experience, which does seem odd. And I think the question will be if this amounts to a real conflict of interest for her, if she did something that seems like it really calls her job into question and the role that he and she are playing in this case into question. I just can't tell yet. Until she responds and we know what actually happened, then I'm kind of reluctant to draw a lot of conclusions.
If she is forced to resign, if her reputation is tarnished, is this case so intimately tied to her that the case is fatally wounded? Or is it just like, oh, no, there are other prosecutors in the office that can carry it forward. They haven't been having vacations with Nathan Wade.
Yeah, I haven't heard anything yet that suggests that the case is conflicted out in a way that the charges would have to be dropped. On the other hand, you know, if there is a scandal that involves her, she's a key figure. She made a bunch of tough decisions to bring these charges. She designed this big sprawling case. And, you know, Trump will have a total field day politically with all that if it's really true. And then, you know, what would happen if she resigned, bringing in a new prosecutor? She's an elected official. How would that all work? Would that person continue the case? Like, just think of all the delay that would entail. And, you know, the clock is ticking. So let's see what happens, though, before we jump to conclusions about this.
All right. Before we leave this, the depressing veil of Trump and the Trump world, let's nod at Chris Christie, who dropped out of the Republican presidential race, accepting the inevitable before the New Hampshire primary. Will we miss him, Jamel? Was this a tremendous lost opportunity? Will it have any impact on the race? Does it make it possible for Nikki Haley, say, to win New Hampshire and then change the dynamics of the Republican primary?
You know, I'll say I've always been skeptical of Christie's entry into the race in the first place. Like, the whole "I'm going to tell the truth to the voters" always struck me as sort of, okay, whatever guy, we'll see. Because as people might remember, back in 2016, he was one of the early, you know, institutional supporters of Donald Trump. And so it's like, okay, whatever guy. But he spent his time in the race, like, directly going after Trump, directly going after the other candidates who refused to sort of even criticize Trump. He in his sort of speech announcing that he'd be leaving the race, he straight up said, like, "I don't think anyone who can't tell the truth about this guy is qualified to be president," and took a direct shot at Haley and DeSantis, and said that he wasn't going to play any part in this guy getting elected. I don't think his departure necessarily is going to impact the race for the nomination. I'm not sure that his supporters are going to flock to Haley or anything. But I do think this is all very noteworthy. It's like very noteworthy to see not a House backbencher, not someone long out of, you know, Republican politics denounce Trump in this way, but like a guy who could have been president, right? Chris Christie, my view is that if Chris Christie had run in 2012, he very well could have been president. Like, this is a guy who very much has like the skill set to be a successful presidential candidate. And him coming out and saying, "This guy cannot be president. Donald Trump cannot be president. And you should not vote for anyone who cannot say that clearly." I think that's at least significant. And I'll be interested to see how it plays out, not with Republican voters, not like Republican primary voters, but with the universe of people who might lean Republican and might consider voting Republican and who maybe hold Christie in some esteem, how they're going to respond to him over the next months.
Hey, Jon Favreau here. There's no shortage of political takes in 2024, but quantity doesn't cut it. We need a better conversation about the latest, biggest election of our lives. On Pod Save America, me and my co-hosts cut through the noise to help you figure out what matters and how you can help. Every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday, Pod Save America is breaking down the political news that makes us laugh, cry, and snap our laptops in half. Expensive year for laptops. Make sure to check out new episodes of Pod Save America on your favorite podcast platform or our YouTube channel now.
If you want to understand what is happening in the United States right now, you really need to understand what's happening with the courts, the law, and the Supreme Court. The battle between democracy and whatever this cage match is that we're witnessing, it's going to be won and lost at the ballot box, but it's also going to be won and lost in the courtrooms. I'm Dahlia Lithwick. I host Slate's legal podcast, Amicus, and we are doubling our output, bringing you weekly episodes from here on in, because how else can we keep an eye on the many trials of Donald Trump, the conservative legal movement's assaults on our rights, the Supreme Court's latest slate of environmental gutting, gun safety eviscerating cases on the docket. So follow Amicus wherever you get your podcasts, new episodes dropping every Saturday morning.
We're joined on the Gabfest again by Alec MacGillis. Alec is a reporter at ProPublica. He's been on with us at least once, maybe several times before, for his incredible reporting. And this week, he has a story in The New Yorker and ProPublica, Has School Become Optional?, about the rise in school absenteeism and the efforts to try to reverse it. Alec, so we've talked on the Gabfest a number of times about the alarming rise of absenteeism in American public schools post-pandemic. You've now given us a great occasion to talk more about it. Can you just start us off by giving some data on absenteeism and tell us what absenteeism is?
Sure. The numbers we usually use are the numbers for what's called chronic absenteeism. And so that's students who miss at least 10% of days. So in a typical school year, that's 18 days of the school year that they're missing. The rate of chronic absenteeism nationwide was about 15% before the pandemic, the last full school year before the pandemic. It shot up to, it almost doubled, shot up to 28% in the first full school year after schools came back, the 2021-22 school year. So almost doubled after the pandemic. It has come down slightly since then. We don't have nationwide numbers yet, but in the states that have reported since for last school year, there's been some modest improvement, but it's still much higher than it was before the pandemic.
Just to clarify, absenteeism is not necessarily unexcused absences. It's absence for any reason. So it could be for illness, but it could also be unexcused.
The way that states report, districts report, might vary somewhat at the margins as far as whether an unexcused absence would still count as being whether an excused absence would still count as being absent, but and that gets into a whole other problem where a lot of states have found that the rates of excused absences vary a lot by sort of race and class. That you're much more likely to get your absence excused if you're white and middle class. So that's a whole other kind of ballgame.
So the concern that I think is driving your reporting is that some families are losing the habit of going to school every day, that it feels less essential, and that there's a lot of learning getting lost for kids, right? That school, there's a great historical section in your piece about the transition from the 19th to 20th century, where in the United States, going to school every day until you're at least 16 years old becomes a norm. And if you don't do it, you get called a dropout, and that's bad. And the question I think your piece is asking is whether COVID eroded that really important norm. And I just wanted to ask you what you found about that and what you think the kind of causes of the erosion are now that the pandemic is over.
Yes, that really seems to be the fundamental issue here. And there are lots of different reasons why kids don't make it to school on a given day: transportation, health issues, looking out for a younger sibling, all sorts of different reasons. But what you hear from the people on the ground who I was going out with looking for missing students is that there's just been this tremendous erosion of the norm that we had of daily school attendance. Over all these decades, we built up this norm, built up this expectation that this is what you do. And of course, we had chronically absent kids before, we had truant kids before, but now the numbers are such that it really looks as if there's been a loss of that habit, an erosion of that norm, a sense that if you miss school, it's on a given day, it's not that big a deal. And And that what happened during that year or year plus in a lot of districts was that the habit was lost in a sense. The word I kept hearing these workers use and also the families use was comfortable, that people got comfortable just staying at home and doing school from home, doing Zoom school from home. It was in a sense easier. Of course it is. You know, it's easier not to have to get your kid out of bed, easier not to have to get, you know, get kids out into the cold and the rain and the bus. And that it, that in a sense for that year or year plus, we did in a way give ourselves a pass to a certain degree for you know, lots of obviously reasons that were that justification at the time. And but now it's been really hard to kind of get back into that norm. And that really is the core. What do you, the core question here, what do you do when this social norm that had built up over the generations is suddenly so eroded? How do you get that back?
Alec, what kind of interventions do you think that school districts, that state governments even could make to begin to renormalize regular school attendance? I can imagine something punitive, but that doesn't seem like it would be particularly helpful or effective.
Right. There's been a, and there has been a big shift away from punitive the last couple decades, which has been quite striking to see that a lot of states that even states that still have truancy laws in the book are not enforcing them all that much. There was this very interesting episode in 2019 when Kamala Harris, you know, came under fire, in the Democratic presidential primary for her, pretty tough measures that she was, you know, was, pushing as San Francisco DA and then California Attorney General on the truancy front, where she was really trying to do some pretty tough enforcement. So there's been a move away from the sort of legal court approach to the problem. And so one intervention is the one that I was reporting on, which is doing home visits, sending out people, whether they're private employees of a private company, as was the case in my article, or school employees, community members working on behalf of the schools, going out and visiting homes of students who are chronically absent to try to figure out what's going on, try to figure out what the obstacles are, and kind of get that information back to the schools. Another intervention is to do basically reminders, like kind of like text reminders, email reminders to families, kind of nudge them that way, often with stats showing how sort of how their students' absenteeism attendance fits in with others, and trying to kind of use a sort of peer pressure to get parents and students to attend better. There are other efforts within schools where you basically take kids that have been missing a lot of school and just give them a whole lot of extra attention with weekly meetings with mentors or staff members, or possibly even representatives of the DA's office who are kind of coming in to sort of gently, gently suggest that they ought to start attending more consistently so that they avoid eventual legal actions. Some states are, back to the punitive front, are also threatening to not necessarily take people, you know, to jail, which has been done at the extreme end, but there has been the threat of removing cash assistance from families. That's happened at the margins in Michigan, where I was doing my reporting. And then finally, there is a notion of possibly incentivizing attendance, you know, just straight cash incentives for attendance. You see that mentioned somewhat as well. Over all this, I would say the important thing is to note is that this probably shouldn't just be on the schools themselves. That's what I kept hearing from people, that this has become such a huge crisis, millions of students not attending at the levels that they were before the pandemic, that it really is kind of on all of us and society as a whole, on government as a whole, to grapple with this. The fact is that we as a society made the decision to close schools to in-person instruction for a year or more in lots of the parts of the country. And we did that for the sake of society. And that came with consequences that we're now seeing. And in a way, it's now really on society as a whole to grapple with this problem.
Alec, when you look at these data, one thing that really is striking is that there are places that are massively worse than other places. So I live in Washington, D.C., where the chronic absenteeism rate is almost 50%. Chicago, similarly, almost 50%. Alaska, New Mexico are in the 40s. The places where it's you know, even more epidemic, where it's so disturbingly high. What distinguishes them from the places where it's just bad?
Well, it's definitely much worse in our cities. One should note, though, that the rate has gone up just about everywhere. This is something that we're seeing even in better off, you know, suburban districts. You're seeing higher rates of absenteeism even there. We're seeing it at all grade levels. This is really, you know, K to 12 problem. The rate, you know, it's not very complicated. The rates have gone up the most, or are now the highest in the places where they were high before, and so they're higher in cities that have high rates of poverty and all the challenges that come with that. And what we're also seeing is that, I mean, this is something that we should be, you know, worried about regardless, because kids get so much from being in school. But you have seen in cities like Washington, which you just mentioned, at the same time as we're seeing these high rates of absenteeism, we have seen high rates of other things like car thefts. And not all car thefts are, of course, being done by young people, but a lot of them are. And it's not complicated, again, that when kids aren't in school, you know, might be spending their time doing things that aren't healthy. One should also note, though, that most of the kids who are missing school, this is what I found when I was going around with these workers in Michigan, are not out causing trouble. They're at home by themselves on their phone, playing video games, sleeping late. They're alone. They're on their own, and that's actually one more reason to be concerned about this, because it's actually the isolation that comes with this that is so especially concerning.
Well, I find this whole topic so heart-wrenching, and I think the reason is that I feel like there's a dilemma at the center of it, which is that school is really important. We have lots of data about what an important role it plays in kids' lives for learning and social reasons. And yet at the same time, it seemed like the families who were having this problem with chronic absenteeism, for the most part, there was nothing like deliberate on the parents' part. It was a sign of them being overwhelmed by having two jobs or all the other struggles of poverty and dysfunction that were going on. And so it seemed like there's a promising aspect of your reporting, which is these home visits. I kind of fastened on to them as a way to try to reach out to families, find out what's wrong, like a kid missing a winter coat, a problem, a practical problem that could get solved. And it kind of reminded me of the data about how when you send nurses into the homes of people with babies, that can really improve the health of the kids and the families. And I wondered if there's some way that your reporting suggests that there's actually like an opportunity here to more closely connect schools or the companies that outsource these home visits to these families so that we're learning more about them, that they're getting pulled back into the social fabric.
Absolutely. And that is the sort of ideal promise of this approach. You're reaching out to them. You're showing that you actually care. I mean, a lot of the families would go, you know, I was doing this day after day, and you'd go to some homes where the people were really kind of, you could tell they were startled that the school had actually cared enough to send someone out to them to see what was going on. And right there, that's some kind of a message that this matters and that society is concerned. It does take a ton of effort. And what I saw was that the approach being taken by this company could definitely be improved on. They've chosen to do it basically just cold calling. They go door to door. They've got a list of names and addresses, and very often people aren't home or they're not awake, and you're left standing at the door without an answer, and you just leave a letter at the door. And whereas Connecticut, which has really been a forerunner in this, as a state in trying to deal with this problem, they're doing home visits where in a different way, they're actually making appointments ahead of time, and they're really setting up like often hour long visits with families. It might even be at the Dunkin' Donuts if they don't want to, you know, have people come to their home, but it's a very intensive meeting that happens, and it's done by school employees or community members who are being paid by the schools to do it. And it's much more deliberate in that sense. The people at the company I was with said that they actually prefer going cold call because they feel like it gives them a more honest, candid look at what's actually going on in the home than if someone has prepared for a visit and kind of has their story together, as it were. But definitely, if one can figure out how to do these visits in the most effective way, they hold a lot of promise.
Alec McGillis has written, "Has school become optional?" in The New Yorker and ProPublica. Alec, thanks for coming on the GabFest.
Thank you for having me.
Let's go to cocktail chatter. Emily, you're outside your home. You have a respite from the dreariness in New Haven. So you're filled with joy and light, and probably you're liquored up already, even though it's only 9 a.m. What are you going to be chattering about?
Ooh, such allegations coming my way. I am at that time of the year where I try to go and catch up on all the movies that I missed, which is pretty much all the movies. And it is true that some of the movies I'm excited to see from 2023 are not streaming yet, but I saw two movies in the last couple of weeks which I thought were so good. The first one is Past Lives, which was a big hit, I think, at the Sundance Film Festival. I knew nothing about this, but now I've gone off and read about it. So good. Such a movie about like really pretty normal people who you could imagine actually meeting, but really lovely and quite dramatic and moving. And then the other movie, which seemed to have nothing to do with real life, at least to me, is Anatomy of a Fall, which is a kind of thriller movie with wildly implausible court scenes, which I thought was really good. So Past Lives, Anatomy of a Fall, if you haven't seen them yet.
Jamel, what is your chatter?
I'm also in the catching up on movies, part of the year. Every January, I tell myself I will only watch movies from the previous year, just to make sure I get everything. I have not yet seen Past Lives or Anatomy of a Fall, but they're on my list. I did see something, though, that is not going to be up for any awards, but it's still very good. And it is a Chilean martial arts film called The Fist of the Condor. And it is, I forget the lead whose name I forget was in John Wick 4 as like a grunt who got beat up. And it's this very short, like 80-minute film just about this like martial arts monk in the mountains of Chile protecting a book that contains like the secrets of, you know, ancient Incan martial arts. It's a little, I mean, it's a very kind of throwbacky film, like very reminiscent of a 1970s kung fu flick, which is to say it's like the premise is extremely contrived and the plot only exists for you to see martial artists go at each other for a bunch of time. And it's worth it. It's some of the most incredible practical martial arts stuff I've seen on film in a very long time. It is actually kind of remarkable to see the kind of stuff that doesn't feel like is being made anymore, but is. And so I'm gonna really recommend this. It's again a very short watch, a perfect kind of like Friday night watch. And if you're interested at all in martial arts films, The Fist of the Condor is one of the best ones I've seen in a very long time.
That was a very specific kind of recommendation. I'm about to give either, as I said, the greatest or worst cocktail chatter in my life. So we'll see. But first, before I do that, my girlfriend and I are going to take a long weekend in Amsterdam in February. I've had such great luck in years past with GabFest listeners sending me tips, places to eat. I've met up with some of you. Maybe you lead an amazing walking tour of Amsterdam. What's the great day trip from Amsterdam? If you have thoughts, please email them to me at davidplotz@gmail.com or at gabfest@slate.com. Okay, here we go. You guys need to pay attention to this. It can be very important. So I had a dream the other night, and I finally, after this dream, understand how the prophets of old felt, how like Hezekiah and Jeremiah and Hosea understood that a greater power was speaking to them. because I had such a dream the other night, and a powerful vision came to me, and it's shaken me to my core. And I feel like St. Teresa of Avila or the prophet Nahum, that I have to bear witness. So what is it that came to me in a dream? I'll get to it in a second.
I don't know. So far, I'm kind of terrified.
What is it that came to me in a dream? Okay. I'll get to that in a second. Have you ever thought about what is the most consecutive times the same letter can appear in a sentence or phrase? For example, there are no English words that I can think of that have the same letter three times in a row. It's not counting sort of written down articulations like gr or arg. But there are lots of words that have double letters, like the word keep, K-E-E-P, you know, double E. So can you create a sentence that has the same letter more than two times in a row? You can. It's easy, in fact, to think of a sentence or a phrase that has the same letter four times in a row. Imagine you're a Halloween DJ. You might tell your friends, I MC eerie parties. So MC, E-M-C-E-E, E-E-R-I-E for eerie. You have MC ends with two E's, eerie starts with two E's, you get four E's in a row. So the question, of course, and a lot of philosophers and mathematicians have asked this question, is can you do more than four of the same letter in a row? And I am here to tell you that it's possible. And the reason I know it's possible is because it came to me in a dream. I'm not shitting you. Literally, a phrase emerged wholly to me in a dream the other night. In the same way that for Jeremiah, the phrase, you know, for I know the plans I have for you, plans to prosper, not harm you, plans to give you hope in a future, the way that came to the prophet Jeremiah, a phrase came to me. So here is the phrase that came to me. And before I say it, I need to set up the scenario where you would say this phrase. So you are a southerner, like Jamel, in fact, here. You are visiting South America with your family, and you tell them that tomorrow you're going to have a day trip with local pack animals. What would you tell them? Obviously, what you'd say is, kids, tomorrow y'all a llama ride. So let's break it down.
That's four.
No, it's not. Y'all. Okay. Y'all. It's a future tense. So y'all, which is an informal plural form of the pronoun you, Y-A-L-L, ends in two L's. Then there's an apostrophe, contractional L-L, to create the future contraction will. That's two more L's. And then the animal llama, which starts with two L's. That's six consecutive appearances of the letter L in a correct English sentence. Can anyone do better? I don't think so. God sent it to me in a dream. So probably not. And I didn't do any Googling to see whether. I haven't even checked this in Google. But I don't need to check in Google because God sent it to me. I did run it by an English professor and a scholar, and she gasped in amazement and accepted it as a legitimate sentence. That English professor, that was my mother, to be sure, but she did accept it. But I'm looking forward to more of such prophetic revelations, and I'm going to share them with the GabFest audience when they occur. I literally woke up in the middle of the night. I wrote it down.
List.
Y'all, llama. It literally came to me, and here I am today.
There is a God, and he's a very dedicated Scrabble player.
But listeners, you've sent them your chatters to us at gabfest@slate.com. If you've had dreams, if you've had revelations, or if you just have read something wonderful, you should send it to us. And our listener chatter this week comes from Aaron Bumgardner.
Hello, GabFest listeners. This is Aaron Bumgarner calling in from Arlington, Massachusetts. I've been chattering a lot recently about the e-newsletter called The Art of Noticing by Rob Walker, which offers useful ideas, practical prompts, and unexpected inspiration for people who want to stay interested in life. In one recent issue, the author talks about a friend who requested a special noticing project as she rode public transportation during a week-long experiment of no multitasking. A few of the ideas in the newsletter included focusing on what you can see out the window. Another idea was to turn people into a series of games by tracking who's on the train for the longest portion of your trip. I don't often ride public transportation myself, but this got me thinking about all different kinds of special noticing projects that we can use to be more mindful and creative about our day-to-day activities. I thought listeners might find this idea intriguing, especially as we're thinking about resolutions and intentions for the new year. I hope you enjoy.
Thank you. That's our show for today. The Gabfest is produced by Chana Roth. Our researchers, Julie Hugan. Our theme music is by the Imagine Giants. Ben Richmond is Senior Director for Podcast Ops. And Alicia Montgomery is the VP of Audio for Slate. For Emily Bazelon and the delightful Jamel Bowie, who can come back anytime he wants, I'm David Plotz. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next week. How are you? So a listener named Deep Ubi sent us a Slate Plus idea months ago, and I kept trying to get John to do it because I was like, John, you'd like it. And he's like, no, it requires too much thought. It's going to require too much preparation. I can't. It's too big a question. And I was like, come on, John. And then John is on vacation. So I thought, sneak it around him, because Emily is game for anything. And I knew that our Jamel would immediately cotton on to this. And so Deep sends us something that they got off Twitter, which is, you're in charge of choosing four presidents for new Mount Rushmore-like memorial. The rules are all four presidents must be deceased. I think we can put an asterisk on that if people want to change that. You can't choose any of the current Mount Rushmore presidents. Feel free to consider accomplishments outside the presidency. What are your choices? So to me, it's like, two of these are super obvious, and then two are kind of open. But I'm maybe Jamel. I'm gonna give you first crack. You pick your first.
Okay. All right. So I want to say that you earlier when you previewed this earlier, you said that it'd be hard to actually make another Mount Rushmore, and I'm going to say no. All we would have to do is expropriate Stone Mountain, kind of like blast the remaining Confederates off of, and then we have our tableau.
That is so helpful, because I was objecting to the whole premise of creating another environmental monstrosity. So I like that solution very much.
Okay, so in the spirit of expropriating Stone Mountain, my first pick is JQA, John Quincy Adams, not because his presidency was all that distinguished, although, you know, when you look at what came next, Andrew Jackson and Martin Van Buren and Indian removal, he looks very good in contrast. But more because JQA, as I think many listeners may know, left the presidency and then was serving the House of Representatives basically until his death. And in the House was an outspoken opponent of slavery, was an outspoken opponent of efforts by Southern representatives to gag discussion of slavery on the floor, was a really pivotal person in sort of like the emergence of political anti-slavery in the 1830s and 1840s. So JQA goes up. Next, in the
similar spirit, no. You get one. You get. We're gonna do one. We'll do one.
That's it.
That's number one.
That's my one.
We'll get
to
everybody's.
All right.
But I'm also JQA was on mine. I'm just gonna say also there. Agree with that. He was my fourth choice. Emily, what's your first?
I accept that. FDR seemed like he should make it for the New Deal, for saving the country from the Great Depression, for the era of greater equality and social programs that he brought in, and then for successfully waging World War II.
Yes. Okay. Was FDR on your list, Jamel?
Yes, FDR is on my list.
FDR. So we all had FDR. All right. So FDR is down. All right. My first one, no surprise to anyone who's listened to the Gabfest for all these years, Ulysses S. Grant, obviously, you know, the greatest of our military leaders, the most astonishing human story, his rise from nothing to the leadership of the nation in practically no time at all is probably the most amazing American success story there's ever been. He was a better president than he's given credit for. He did fight for Reconstruction. He fought to break the Klan. He did try to maintain Black economic and political power, and was a marvelous person to boot.
That was just a snippet from our Slate Plus conversation. If you want to hear the whole conversation, go to slate.com/gabfestplus to become a member today.